Hey, so tonight we're going to have a little fireside chat about economic policy as it relates to the current fiscal. Oh, that's a different. About Meta. And I've given this talk, you know, over the years. I call it Choosing Love. And it's kind of cool. There's a bumper sticker out there now. You may have seen it around Choosing Love. It's funny how these things all sort of like co-occur in our culture. But just want to start by giving you a little pep talk. Whatever's happening, you're on the first day of retreat, and you just have to keep that in mind. If you've done retreat before, there's a tendency to compare to past retreats, and you're usually comparing to like the eighth day when you had that, you know, illumination, you know, when you've had a lot of practice behind you. We really need to just keep perspective that we're in the first day of retreat, and there's a lot of really deconditioning to do from our life. And, you know, we do have a culture that's just like turbocharged in distraction. I think it's safe to say we're the most distracted culture in the history of the earth. And, you know, a few years back, they started having the TVs in the gas pumps. Like, God forbid, there should be the 2 minutes when you're filling up your car that you don't have something to occupy your mind with. And now you get the TV, but you get, like, the crawl, you know, down below. And then you get, like, the sports update on the left. And, you know, there's, like, five things coming at you. In the gas, just from filling up the gas. And so, you know, all of this conditions us to be really used to being stimulated. And it's hard to come on retreat and it's like, what? All we're going to do is sit and walk, you know, and go out in the woods. So that's nice. So really just, you know, be kind to yourself. No need to judge yourself. It's just the way it is for, you know, as we enter retreat. So again, it takes a lot of patience. And one example that I just find quite amazing. There's this weekly news digest called The Week. And, you know, they summarize lots of news from, you know, both sides of the spectrum, left and right. And for my, you know, poor memory brain, it's kind of nice to just, you know, read a story that's a paragraph long. And, but anyway, they have lots of little tidbits in there, and they do kind of strange but funny news stories. And one of them in July issue, in a small town in Minnesota, I don't remember where, but a burglar was arrested. He had broken into a house, and during the robbery, he logged onto the homeowner's computer and checked his Facebook page. If that wasn't distracted enough, it's like you can't even rob a house without checking your Facebook page. And I don't do Facebook, but the original idea was, this is what I'm doing now, right? So I don't think he said, I'm robbing a house, but he didn't do that. But what he did do was he left his Facebook page up on the screen. And the homeowner comes home, his home is broken into, he gets onto his computer, and there's a funny looking Facebook page. So the guy was busted for that. So, you know, this is sort of how we're being conditioned. And it's useful in so many ways, but it's also very speedy and, you know, very distraction-making. So again, be patient with yourself. It's just going to take a little time to sink into the practice. But feel good about the fact that you're here. You're showing up. You're doing the sitting and walking. And that's what you can do. You can't do anything else. You know, this is what we got on retreat. Just showing up and doing the practice. And, you know, it really isn't up to us when our mind finally settles down. But it will settle down if we just stick with it. So just to kind of lighten the mood a little bit, I just want to throw some humor at you. And some of it's meditation related, some of it isn't. But the Buddha used a simile about our busy mind. It you know, he taught and grew up in India, so he talked about monkey mind, that, you know, our thinking mind is just like a monkey swinging through the trees, going from one vine to another, you know, letting go of one vine and grabbing another and just swinging along. And so we like to joke about our monkey mind in the meditation world. So lo and behold, there's a cartoon in the New Yorker about monkey mind. There's a patient in bed, and the doctor is standing next to him and saying, and he's got a bandage around his head, and the doc is saying, "We found this in your brain." And you just got to see the cartoon. It's a little tiny, it's a little monkey. So if we can just pass that. And here's a cartoon from Breer. Buddhist compliment. One monk to another. "I've never met anyone so thoughtless in my life." It's a teacher to a student. "Keep up the good work." "Thank you, master." And this one, you'll have to see the picture, but there's a squirrel on a little Buddha statue, and the squirrel's saying, "Oh, forgive me. It's just your head looks a lot like an acorn." Kind of the tradition in Buddhism is to have the Buddha with a top knot on his head, so it looks very much like an acorn. So a little Buddhist humor, and then a little poking fun at New Age spirituality, and the whole idea, you know, of the law of attraction. So one duck is talking to another in a pond. This is a Kaplan cartoon. One duck is saying to the other, "Maybe you should ask yourself why you're inviting all this duck hunting into your life right now." And lastly, just to kind of poke fun at our youth and our age, this is a recent cover of the New Yorker, and it's granddad, pop, and son in their bathing suits. The son, of course, is shagging, so you can see his butt crack. The father is just kind of a normal bathing suit, and then the granddad has his bathing suit way up high. So the waistline just rises as we age, apparently. So our retreat is love and wisdom, and we're practicing the love side, and or the kindness side, and tomorrow afternoon we'll switch to mindfulness practice. We'll be practicing the wisdom side. Through mindfulness, we see clearly how things are, and that's wisdom. So, the Tibetans have a saying, well, it's a mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum. And it's the mantra of the Bodhisattva Chenrezig. So, in the Tibetan practice, you recite the mantra, you imagine the deity of compassion, Chenrezig, or you may have heard the name Avalokiteshvara, or if you're familiar with Zen, Kuan Yin, but it's the same deity of compassion. So you chant the mantra, and you kind of channel, in a way, the spirit of compassion through this mantra. And if you were to translate it literally, Om Mani Padme Hum is the jewel is in the lotus. There's actually a book written, The Jew is in the Lotus, about Jubus, Judaism and Buddhism. So it's a spoof on that title, but I digress. Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel is in the lotus. Actually, that for me is the image of this union of love and wisdom. So the lotus represents the empty heart. And as Westerners, when we hear empty heart, we think, oh, lonely, empty, desolate. It's not that. It's empty as in empty of the separateness, of this empty of the belief that we are a separate self over here, separate from everything. So when you hear the word emptiness in Buddhism, that's what it means. Emptiness, empty of separation. So it's really fullness. An empty heart means it's a spacious heart. It's a heart that allows things to come in. And so the ultimate expression of awakened mind is emptiness, is this seeing through the illusion of separate self. When this empty, meaning full, heart meets the world, the natural expression is love. And that's the jewel in the lotus. The Om Mani Padme Hum. The jewel is in the lotus. Our heart is empty and the world fills us up. And there's just love. So mindfulness really actually is love in its purest form. It's love without any attachment whatsoever. And we often, we think of love as attention, right? So mindfulness is this pure attention. Without attachment, we don't need anything to be different. So that's my favorite image for kind of this integration of love and wisdom and our two practices. And then it just depends, you know, some people are really drawn to the metta practice. Some people really struggle with it. And vice versa with mindfulness. So we're exposing you to both. And then you get to take home what speaks to you. So love, again, is this expression of the awakened heart. It's natural. It's effortless. When we're at our best, when we're at our most awake, our most mindful, we just naturally respond with love. And I think many of us would agree that the example really of our times of wisdom and love being together, the jewel being in the lotus, is the Dalai Lama himself, who, no coincidence, is considered an emanation of the deity of compassion. It's considered an emanation of Chenrezig. So his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, really makes sense. He's wise and he's kind. If you've been around him at all, you know, seen him or done teachings with him, you know, you just sort of see he's very calm, he's very clear, and very responsive, very expressive. He came to the Front Range 7 or 8 years ago, and we drove up to Shambhala Mountain Center from Boulder, about an hour drive, and it was a September morning. It was freezing cold. He was going to make a quick appearance there, and then go from there by helicopter to the Pepsi Center in downtown Denver and give a teaching to 20,000 people. Cool. Great. Well, I was on the other end, and there was maybe 500 of us up at this Dharma Center. And we sat there in the freezing cold morning, you know, just waiting for the Dalai Lama. And a little after sunrise, we hear the pow, 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 and this helicopter comes over the trees, and then it lands somewhere. So we know that the Dalai Lama has landed. We're still freezing and waiting, and then he's driven up to the stupa where we all were. And then, you know, he spoke, and he was given awards, and he was up there freezing, the poor guy. I mean, they were, like, trying to wrap blankets around him and everything, and there was an interreligious panel up on the stage. There was a rabbi, an imam from the Muslim tradition. Queen Noor of Jordan was there. Buddhist teachers were there. And at one point, by accident, the Dalai Lama referred to the imam as rabbi. So he basically just called a Muslim a Jew. And then you see this little, like, huddle of the translator, like, talking to the Dalai Lama, and, you know, this sort of confusion. And then you see this look on the Dalai Lama's face, and he looks up like this, and he looks at, it was not 500, it was more like 2,000 or 3,000 people. He looks at all of us, okay? You're on stage. You've just called, you know, an imam a rabbi. What do you do? He just said, "Big mistake!" And then just laughed, and everybody was cracking up. So he was done. It was, you know, obviously no harm, no foul, nothing intended. You know, what people don't often know about the Dalai Lama is that he is a deeply intelligent man. He got his PhD, his Geshe, in Tibetan philosophy at the age of 16. He could expound on the 30-something flavors of emptiness, you know, or the difference between the Vaibhashika, Sutantrika, Chitta Matra, and Madhyamaka schools of Tibetan Buddhism. But he never does, unless you really sign up for that program, because he's about beaming compassion. So if you consider that in him, and you also consider, you know, that he's the now just the spiritual head. He's no longer the political head. He dethroned himself from that. So anyway, he, you know, but he's oversees the, you know, Tibetan population, which has been decimated by the Chinese. You know, something like 20% of the population destroyed at the hands of the Chinese. 20%. You know, that's like 60 million Americans. That's just overwhelming what's happened in Tibet. So in spite of his deep, sharp, scholarly, intellectual mind, you don't see that. In spite of the tremendous suffering he has to face on a daily basis, you know, in the Tibetan situation, he still is just beaming kindness. And you know, he says, "My religion is simple. My religion is kindness." Just a really inspiring guy. And I asked Jack Kornfield about the Dalai Lama once. You know, Jack's spent time around him, you know, personally, and just said, you know, is the Dalai Lama, I mean, he seems so natural in public, but in private, is he sort of a grouch behind the curtain, you know? And Jack's like, "No, not at all. He's exactly the same. If he's in front of a few people or 3,000, he's just the same guy." So, so he, to me, is just such a shining light. You just get this sense with him. It's like he's got this love light, and it's just shining. And whoever walks in front of the beam, you know, gets to be blessed by that. This really hard-boiled scientist, Paul Ekman, psychologist, started doing these, being part of these science and religion dialogues with the Dalai Lama. And at one point, the Dalai Lama sat with Paul and his daughter and just held their hands and talked to them and rubbed their hands. And this is how he describes that encounter. This was what some people would call a mystical transforming experience. I was inexplicably suffused with physical warmth during those 5 or 10 minutes, a wonderful kind of warmth throughout my body and face. It was palpable. I felt a kind of goodness I'd never felt before in my life all the time I sat there. And then he goes on to say, for most of his life, he had kind of a turbulent childhood. He said, I have at least once a week an anger outburst that he would really regret. He says, I'm someone who has struggled his whole life with flare-ups of anger, but even now, almost a year later, they're very rare. I believe the physical contact with that kind of goodness can have a transformative effect. You can hear his, you know, science lingo. So, kindness, when it's fully developed, you know, is bright and strong and alert and intelligent like the Dalai Lama. So he really is, again, and this is just my personal bias, such a beacon for me of this quality. Now, you might or might not know that as a monk, you know, and as a spiritual head of a country, you know, he has a lot going on. But you may or might not know, he practices 4 hours a day. I mean, he's got a practice, you know, a daily practice. He gets up super early. So he's had a lot of chance to choose love, to cultivate love. So he's not just some, like, you know, pie-in-the-sky guy who's just kind of plopped into this earth, you know, Mr. Friendly. Well, he kind of was, but... You know, he's the 14th Dalai Lama, so, you know, he's had a lot of practice. But the point is, he's that way through practice. It's not just, you know, genetic. We can really develop these qualities. The Buddha said this quality of metta, of loving kindness, of friendliness, can be developed immeasurably. Metta is one of the four immeasurables. It's a quality of the realized, awakened heart that has no limits. And as I said earlier today, that limitless quality of heart is limited by our mental habits. We don't typically choose love. We typically choose, you know, many other things on the menu that are not often on the positive side of the equation. And that's natural. It's not our fault. It's kind of our evolutionary heritage, you know? So the good news is we can work at it. We can become more loving through practice, which is nothing other than just consciously directing our mind towards that which helps us be more friendly. Vincent van Gogh said, the more I think about it, the more I realize there is nothing more artistic than to love others. He knew. He knew it was a practice. So, our negativity bias limits our ability to love. And then, you know, our elaborate stories can limit our ability. Again, like I said this morning, the head sort of needs all the stories. The heart doesn't need it at all. The heart is so simple. It just wants to connect. Just to be. I was once playing soccer and a pickup game, and there was a family there. A dad was playing in our game, and then something happened over on the sidelines where one of his kids fell down, and he was crying. So Harry rushed over. And then this other kid, I don't even know where she came from. She was about six. This boy was about four. She just came over and stood next to him. That's all she did. And she just kind of like looked at him and smiled at him. But you could so tell she was just there for him. It was just this tiny little moment. I don't know why it struck me so strongly. But that was metta. Just so simple. That's the heart. So simple. Nothing was said. It was just this exchange. That's all she was doing, was just letting her calm, kind presence be next to him so he could kind of like find his bearings again. That's the heart. Big stories, not needed. So as we explore the metta practice, we've done easy being, and now we're working with neutral being. We'll go into another category of tomorrow. As we do this with metta, classically the way it's taught is the far enemy of metta, meaning the thing that gets in the way of metta, which is not at all like metta, is judging mind, is aversion. And we recognize very clearly that gets in the way. What's classically considered called the near enemy, it's the obstacle that looks more like metta. The near enemy of metta is attached love, or desirous love, a love that's less about wishing the person well and more about wanting to get something from them. So we necessarily walk both paths. Wendy talked about aversion earlier today. We'll walk that path with the metta practice. And we can also walk the desire path or the attached path, where we want something from them or want some outcome, want something to happen. So I want to just focus on how our romantic love, can get a little confused. So the ideal, this is what we're wanting, right? When we fall in love, what we're wanting is for that honeymoon period, right, to just be there forever. But if it was, then it wouldn't be called the honeymoon period. But in the honeymoon period, it might look a little bit like this. Here's another cartoon. Man and a woman on a couch, gazing at each other. Their noses are touching. They're in deep eye contact, holding hands. And one of them is saying, "I'll be right back. I'm going to blink." Whoa. Isn't that what we're wanting? Forever? Deep, 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 passionate, head over heels in love. Here's another one, and you'll have to see the cartoon, but one snail is talking to another, and they have a kind of curlicue shell, and then off in the distance is a tape dispenser, looking a little bit like the snail shell. And one snail is saying to the other, "I don't care if she is a tape dispenser. I love her." So that's what we're wanting, unconditional love. But here's another cartoon. Often it's not like that at all. So a man and a woman in an argument, not having a good time, and the man is saying, this is a Kaplan cartoon again, "Of course I care about how you imagined I thought you perceived I wanted you to feel." The same couple. The woman angrily looking at the man, and he's sitting in full lotus in the living room. And she's saying, "Can you be in the moment later?" And the classic, miscommunication. Another type. Apologies, but these are all heterosexual, so there's all these cartoons. They're not biased, but the selection is biased. But it's a man and a woman again. And the man is very angrily saying to her, and she's looking very angry, "I never said I love you. I said I love ya." Big difference. And lastly, I have to put this out there because of all my railing against technology. Another happy couple on the beach, hand in hand, and the guy saying to her, "I can't wait to see what you're like online." Okay. So romantic love. Hard, isn't it? But the hope would be you could take some metta back if you are in relationship. And if you're not, you can take it back to your dear friends. But metta, the way Buddhism defines love, is not, how can I advocate for myself and to get my needs met? Or worse, how can I subtly manipulate her, him, to get my needs met? It's all, premised on desire. And we don't want to bash desire. Desire is great. We're here because of desire. The species is here. But, how well does that work for you all the time? There's desire that really works and really helps us connect. And then there's desire that's really a disconnect. So with metta, we turn it around. Rather than trying to figure out what we can get from the person, we just simply be love. We just stop. And we meet our own needs by being the love we're trying to get. We can just be the love rather than trying to get the love. So we can be the love by having this energy of wishing your partner, your sweetie, well. Think about how often your energy in your relationship is in that mode. They don't have to know, right? You can just be doing it. You can just be sending them a little metta wish, just like you did this afternoon to the birds and the bees. So we can really turn it around. A lot of the trouble in our relationships is thinking that, our partner, especially in our culture, is sort of the end-all and be-all. They're our everything, and we have to get every need met from them. And, that can be a real struggle. Of course we want to get our needs met, but, at best we're just going to get the big ones, hopefully met, and not the rest. So we can replace that with metta. Here's a little poem about attached love. It's called Vessel by Patricia Campbell Carlson. Each day I'm a little crazier with missing you. The dog still snores on the couch, her paws dancing through a dream-lit field. The sun sets as usual, illuminating the red-frilled edges of newly emerging wild rose leaves. The veins on the backs of my hand run like ancient rivers towards the depth of the body. Why do I feel I need you? So much more than these ordinary beauties. As if heaven slipped up and poured everything sacred into one single vessel, leaving me wildly aware of the way clay shatters. That's like a pith dharma instruction. She's connecting with her dog, paws dancing through the dreamlit field. the red edges of the newly emerged rose leaves, the way the veins on the back of her hands are like rivers. And she's giving all that up just to just completely lose herself in her obsession. And it's very tenuous, right? Leaving her wildly aware of the way clay shatters. So, you know, the solution is there. It's to let those other things count just as much as your romantic relationship. And we can let our metta, the more we practice metta for others, for ourselves, the more we are the love that we're seeking. The love we want is actually in our heart. We just have to activate it. And we can spend more of our energy loving. And attached love doesn't work simply because we're wanting it to sort of fixate. We're wanting a person to be a certain way. There's a certain way we like our sweeties. And there's other ways we don't like. We want them to just somehow go into the being we like and just get stuck there. And that's not what happens. They're there sometimes and then they fall out of it. So there's a beautiful writing about unattached love, about real love, love that is actually meets life as it is. And it's from The Gift of the Sea by Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's sweetie, wife. She wrote in Gift of the Sea, "When you love someone, you do not love them all the time in exactly the same way from moment to moment. It's an impossibility. It's even a lie to pretend to. And yet this is exactly what most of us demand. We have so little faith in the ebb and flow of life, of love, of relationships. We leap at the flow of the tide and resist in terror its ebb. We are afraid it will never return. We insist on permanency, on duration, on continuity, when the only continuity possible in life, as in love, is in growth, in fluidity. The only real security is not in owning or possessing, not in demanding or expecting, not in hoping even. Security in a relationship lies neither in looking back to what it was in nostalgia, nor forward to what it might be in dread or anticipation, but living in the present relationship and accepting it as it is now. Relationships must be like islands. One must accept them for what they are here and now within their limits. Islands surrounded and interrupted by the sea, continually visited and abandoned by the tides." So we need to be this steady shore, because life and love and relationships are way too changeable. We can't find that steadiness in another, because they're changeable and they have their own crap and we have our own crap, and you know. So metta is one of these things that we can cultivate so that we can just be in this friendly place and just accept the ebb and flow of life. So, just want to say a little bit about the practice now. Classically, the Buddha talked a lot about metta. He didn't specifically himself outline a practice. This practice comes from a very ancient text after the Buddha, called the Visuddhimagga. And the way the practice was codified was as a meditative practice. that allows us, just like Wendy said, a twofold win-win. There's the win of the concentration. When the mind starts to get more unified and more settled on our object, that in and of itself, the brain, the way our brain, our heart mind is wired, somehow we get happy and we get bright and we get more loving. So the concentration is one side of the practice. The other side is the heart side, just the tug, the feeling, you know, that arises. And so the practice is a balance. So the way the practice is devised is it's simple, so we don't just try to kind of love everything all the time, though that can be nice, as we've seen today. It's really designed partially for retreat practice, so that you can keep it simple and have a better chance of going into that more concentration. So, and the practice is built, kindness is built into the practice. So you start with what's easiest, and then you expand your expand your boundaries gradually. As the metta starts flowing, then it's more natural that you could go to harder categories of beings. So we're starting with the easiest, and now we're in the neutral category. The classical progression is to pick a being out of the category of self, meaning me. So that classically is considered the easiest. That isn't always true in the West. The doing metta for yourself is not always the easiest. So we didn't start with that. We just started with some other easy being. So, but anyway, the classical progression goes self, benefactor, dear friend, neutral person, difficult person, all beings. So we're not doing all of that. We just want to keep it simple. So we're going to just give you exposure to easy and neutral, and we'll do another category tomorrow. We're not going to do difficult being tomorrow, because there's just, you know, we want to take you into mindfulness practice, and, you know, that you need to give some time and care to doing metta for difficult beings. But, you know, my recommendation, if you take this practice into your life, is to do it the easiest way possible. So that's why we really emphasize a lot with the easy being today. So anything that gets the little kind of metta motor purring inside you is great. And who cares if it's a kitty? I did a metta for my cat on a three-month retreat, the one I mentioned last night, for quite a chunk of it. And in a group interview, someone told me later, years later, a Dharma buddy, that he just thought that was hysterical, that I was doing metta for my cat when he heard it in the group interview. He kind of broke the rules of group interview. You're supposed to not do that, but who cares? It was kind of funny. But yeah, so it doesn't matter. The object is not important. Anything that gets your heart kind of with a little metta motor purring is good for you. It feels good. So there's some principles behind the practice, which I've already talked about. The first is we're counteracting. It's an antidote to business as usual. Business as usual is negativity bias. Again, it's not personal. It's human. It's not even cultural. It's a human bias in the brain. Studies have shown when expressions on faces are shown, they can somehow, I don't know how this worked, but the study subject pressed a button or something when they could name the emotion, or I guess they name the emotion. So that this people being studied are supposed to name the emotion when a picture of a face is flashed on the screen. And fearful or negative expressions were recognized far more quickly than expressions of happiness. And, you know, think about it. We're social animals, so being able to recognize someone's emotional state is a very important, probably survival tool in our evolutionary past. So, you know, the thought is the negativity bias kind of gave us survival value. The dude who was really paranoid about a tiger lurking in the bushes might have escaped getting eaten, whereas the really, like, chillaxed dude maybe became tiger food. So that's not personal. If that's true, that's just our evolutionary bias. But somehow we can go against it, and we can choose love. So we need to do this because we're already doing the other so much. We need to actively focus on the positive and then also focus on what's universal, the deep stuff like we're doing. Our differences are superficial. What matters most to us is actually what's universal. Our wishes for well-being and ease and health. Everybody wants that. And there's one more principle. So focusing on the positive, keeping the metta view in mind is the second, what I just said, like our humanness. And the third principle behind the metta practice is I'm going to let the Dalai Lama speak the third principle. And this is in a book actually written by a Chinese author who interviewed the Dalai Lama and was really good friends with the Dalai Lama. So kind of moving just that this Chinese person is just really tight buddies with the Dalai Lama. I'm pretty sure it comes from this book called The Wisdom of Forgiveness. So the Dalai Lama is speaking in his broken English. He says, "I always tell people, it's very important to make distinction, actor and act. We have to oppose bad action. But that does not mean we're against that person, that actor. Once action stopped, different action come. Then that person could be friend. That's why today, Chinese is enemy. The next day, there's always the possibility to become friend. And that's why I have no problem forgiving the Chinese for what they've done to my people." Amazing. And he's speaking to his Chinese friend. That's incredible wisdom. And it's so simple. Our trouble with people is not the person. Our trouble is with the things they do, their actions. The person is you or me. The person behind the actions is all of us. The person is that yearning for happiness, for well-being, for ease, for health. We're all that. That's the person. The actions come out of, you know, confusion, ignorance. That is very much getting in the way of that person getting, you know, what they really want. So we need to take action. We need to oppose harmful actions. The Dalai Lama is very clear. We can oppose someone causing harm, but we're not opposing the person. We're opposing the harm. So we can, you know, say stop to the action, but we can on the side be remembering they're a human being trying to be happy just like me. And that can be very hard, right? In your conflicts with coworkers, with friends, where you really feel there's something at stake or you're being disempowered in some ways. It's very hard to keep this in mind. But remember, the person is just some big general, like, really kind of not very smart cloud in our mind. It's a big generality when we find a person threatening. We need, if we can make it more specific, you know, when you do this, it's very threatening to me, as opposed to you are a scary person, right? Those are really different things, really different statements. So we're not going to focus on difficult beings on this retreat, but that principle is really important when we take the practice to the more difficult people. We don't have to like their actions. We want to be very respectful of the harm we might feel in relation with somebody. But we can still remember they're a human being doing something we feel is unskillful. And it's the action we need to oppose, not the person. There's a really great story of this principle being put into action. And on a retreat I was on, a teacher told a story that she had heard about Nelson Mandela tell about his many years in jail. And he was put in solitary confinement on Robben's Island. And he inventoried all the difficulties of being so isolated for so long. You know, I think, how does anyone know how long he was in jail? It was like 28 years or something. It was a long time, and a lot of that was in solitary confinement. So he inventoried all his difficulties. He felt he could bear all of them except one. He had no one to love. Then it hit him. He could love his guards. He finally realized he didn't have to let the physical incarceration imprison his heart. There's always someone to love if you're willing to kind of get out of your head and your stories and drop into the heart, into the metta view, into the focus on the positive, and to the separating actions from actors. We can love people that we don't like. We don't like the action, but we can still love the person. You can love the guards holding you in solitary confinement. I mean, that's a big-hearted person to do that, but he did it. And, you know, what an inspiring person. Okay. I'll just end with some words from the Buddha on metta. You probably know the story that the Buddha left the palace. He left his wife and his one-year-old son because his spiritual calling was so deep. And, you know, that's not the best thing to hear, right? That your spiritual, you know, person that you like, you know, abandoned his wife and his son at 1 year old. But, you know, the way the tradition holds it is he had worked for lifetimes to develop his spiritual practice, and he knew there was a calling that required him to go off and be a total recluse. But later, his son and his former wife and his mom, but all ordained. His mom was his stepmom. So the Buddha advised his son, who was a monk, Rahula, when he was an adult, cultivate, Rahula, a meditation on loving kindness. For by cultivating loving kindness, ill will is banished. That's a very simple statement. You can transform the aversion, you know, by cultivating metta. Cultivate too, Rahula, a meditation on compassion. For by cultivating compassion, you will find harm and cruelty disappear. The way the tradition defines compassion is it's just friendliness towards difficulty, towards suffering. And in another statement, the Buddha expounded the 11 advantages of practicing metta. The person who fully develops loving kindness sleeps happily. He or she wakes happily. He or she experiences no evil dreams. Is beloved of men. Is beloved even of non-human beings. Is protected by the gods. Can be harmed neither by fire, poison, or a weapon. Wow. His or her mind is quickly composed. His complexion is serene. At the moment of his or her death, she passes away unbewildered. If she can go no further along the path of realization, she will at least be reborn in the heavenly abode of the Brahma Devas. The classical cosmology of the Buddha. So you practice metta a lot, you're going to be reborn in a heaven realm. So let's just sit for a minute.